Well, Yorey, muchas gracias por estar aquí hoy. Thank you so much for being here. I am so excited to get to know you a little bit better. You seem to have a really interesting career in humanitarian aid. And not only that, but you were able to, you had the opportunity to work during the COVID response, the COVID crisis. And I want you to talk to us about that. And then I want to dive into your project, Tributo a mi Tierra project. Yes. Yes. So Yorey, without further ado, let's get into it.
Awesome. Well, first, thank you so much for having me and for thinking about me, just giving me a space to connect with you so we can kind of chat a little bit more. So, so I had the opportunity to kind of blend my human resources experience with a little bit of humanitarian work when I started working for the federal government. Although I do come from the nonprofit sector, so I have worked with several nonprofits around the DC area who has kind of worked around the humanitarian realm. But I didn't foresee myself actually, when I went into the federal government, actually starting to work in emergency response. So I kind of felt organically in it, if that makes sense. So I have served several missions. One of them has been, of course, COVID response back in 2020. I got the opportunity to, they were looking for people early in the pandemic. The federal government had issued a regulation looking for federal employees to work, to support what was going on in the field. And I had the opportunity to work directly as an executive officer, supporting executive leadership, White House leadership, OMB, with lead scientists and epidemiologists in the field working in the hospital. So we were working with the numbers, pretty much state response, like how the governors were talking with their first aid people, how they were getting the numbers in the field, how was everything doing? So I got to see all that behind the scenes in a time that I feel like it was so crazy, right? There was a lot of misinformation out there. And I got to see the other side where there were so many people so committed to the craft and to making things better and trying to figure out what was going on, that there was no time for misinformation or what we were kind of hearing outside. So it was kind of a privilege to work at that response. I got to know a lot of people, and it was a great experience. Besides the COVID response, I was able to deploy to Hurricane Maria in the field back in 2017, which for me, that hit home, right? Because I am originally from Puerto Rico. And obviously, the people that were serving along with me, we all were committed to help with the recovery efforts because it was so devastating, right? What happened to the island. But when I got to see mi tierra, it hit differently, right? Because I had left Puerto Rico back in 2009 after I got married, moved to the mainland. And then I had an opportunity to go back to help, you know, mi gente, básicamente. And it was a little traumatic. Obviously, I didn't go through what a lot of people went through. Friends and family have a lot of family members that actually live in the island still. My immediate family lives there. My husband's family lives there. So I go back and forth going to Puerto Rico, making sure, you know, everyone is fine.
So that must have been very, very stressful, you know, just like being here, seeing everything happen. And then just, you know, how messy, I guess, the response was as well in terms of aid and in terms of not knowing what was going to happen in Puerto Rico for your loved ones and really for all la gente. So how did you cope with that? And did you feel that, you know, being able to at least support that response gave you some sort of peace in terms of being able to contribute to your community?
So there were different feelings coming up around that time, right? Of course, I felt a sense of duty going back to Puerto Rico to help out, a sense of peace, like you mentioned, because I'm contributing to these recovery efforts and I'm actually there trying to communicate with my family. But also, and this happened across here in the mainland with all of us Puerto Ricans that live outside of Puerto Rico, especially the diasporican, right? Like all of us that actually had that first lived experience living in Puerto Rico and then moving here, it hit us really hard, especially those like 2 or 3 weeks that we couldn't communicate with family members because there was this major blackout that happened that no one was foreseeing. And I got to see that side from my agency side because I was involved in those calls, hearing what was going on when Hurricane Maria hit. And for me, it hit so, like, it was traumatizing. Like, when I heard that they just lost all communication, we just didn't know what happened.
When you decided to move out of the island, how long ago was that? And what sparked that idea of leaving your homeland? And what was that journey? How was that transition? My understanding is that your husband is also from there?
Yes, yes. So I left Puerto Rico in 2009. So my husband at the time, I mean, we were dating at the time, and he had finished his master's degree in engineering. And unfortunately, back in the day, you know, even though when we hit the recession here in 2009, because of our relationship with the U.S., Puerto Rico tends to feel things before, like probably 2 or 3 years before that something hits big here in the mainland, just because of the relationship and the type of loss we have in Puerto Rico. So already in 2007, which was the time that we were kind of all graduating and just finishing our degrees, the unemployment rate of Puerto Rico was bad. So for us, there was this sense that anyone who was a good student, who had their degrees, who were highly educated, you had to leave the island to look for opportunities. And this is something that was very ingrained in us when we went to college. And talking with professors, it was always like, hey, you know, you get your degree, it's cheaper to get it here, you get paid if you're a good student, and then you leave for better opportunities.
So what was the hardest part, Yurei? What was the hardest part of that, getting used to that new life?
I think the hardest part for me, at least, was work environment more than anything, because I didn't see Latinas or people like me where I worked. And it's interesting because, you know, we do are in this DC area that is so diverse, but it's not really diverse in the majority of places we are in. And, you know, the higher you go, it's like the smaller the circle, the smaller the representation. And the other part that was really hard for me was the microaggressions that I experienced. And obviously my experience, you know, we all experience different things. And I know there are a lot of people that went through horrible stuff, but as me, as a Latina, there was a lot of things that was always reminding me that I didn't belong here. You know what I mean?
What were some of the microaggressions? Walk me to some of those examples.
So I think one of the first times I experienced what is this? It was at a charity that is a religious charity, by the way, which is interesting. And I was like talking to this manager, and he was just asking me, how long have you been here? And just like chatting with me. I'm like, well, I've been here for like, I think it was like 2013, 4 or 5 years. And then he just stopped and said, oh, yeah, it's going to take you some time to learn English much better. It's going to take you some time.
Wow.
It was shocking. You know, sometimes I feel like fiery, of course, but I just went completely like numb because I was like, is this happening right now? And he just like went in. It's like, yeah, because you kind of need to learn how to write better, but it will come to you. I know you're going to go ahead and get used to it. Yeah.
That is so not wrong. That is not the place. That is not wrong.
Oh yeah. That was, and thankfully I haven't experienced that again, but that was like one of my first experiences. There was another one, when I was working for another nonprofit in DC, I was like working with some records, HR records. And I think I misplaced a record by mistake. Something happened. And this lady comes to me and she's like, oh, I just found this here. You may have missed it, but you know, just wanted to let you know that normally the alphabet that we use is like A, B, C. She started spelling the alphabet for me. Like, yeah.
Like you were a toddler.
Yeah. Like I was a toddler, and like that type of, like I didn't know the alphabet, and because I spoke Spanish. it was just like very strange for me when she did that. Yeah, so that was another one that was interesting for sure. Yeah.
Jodeim, I want to ask also, you were talking about the representation. What's your position on that?
Oh my God, I have so many feelings about this. And you know, I come from a human resources perspective, which sees it behind the scenes. And I'm really conflicted with what I see. So for example, obviously, I've been in teams, the majority of my life, I've been in teams that I'm the only Latina, or probably like the second one, which is strange, at least for this day, just because of the type of demographics. We have like a big Latino population in DC and Virginia as well. And just, it's just very rare to see Latinas in much higher positions. To this day, for the diversity inclusion piece, and I know we're all like a lot of companies are embracing, you know, they want to be more diversified, they want to give opportunities to everyone. Unfortunately, what I've seen from my end, I feel there's a lot of talk and no action. And I've been in a lot of diversity inclusion groups. I've led diversity inclusion groups in different agencies as well. And the intention, the good intention is there. I just feel the opportunities for other people to be represented in those groups is not there, because it almost feels, because it's so trendy right now, and I hate using this, but it's almost so trendy to say, oh, we have a diversity inclusion group and we want to make sure that we're, you know, listening to all employees. There's also this competition of who's leading these groups, right? People want to look like they're very inclusive, that they're actually, you know, there's good intention behind it. And sometimes that gets lost in translation. That's at least what I've seen. There's companies that I'm sure that are changing the landscape and taking this seriously. I just feel we're not there yet.
Yeah, like it's still, what do you think needs to happen?
Well, they have to listen to the people that have the lived experience. So it has to be more collaborative, and that it has to be, actually, the person coming with the idea of opening the opportunity to others in the floor have to be someone with a lived experience. Normally, the companies that implement this diversity inclusion policy, they all come from higher up. So these are just executive working orders because they want to look a certain way. And it's just very top down. And even though, like, you know, we have these meetings where everyone expresses themselves, there's also some type of control, what you can say or what you can do. So it's just hard to really move forward when there are certain things that are not allowed in an agency or a company. So I'm going to add this as 2 cents. I'm a person who has been doing decolonization work for some years. So it's a little complicated when I work in systems and structures that, you know, are there to hold a certain power. And in all honesty, if you're a person doing decolonization work, you understand that in order to make change, you have to dismantle. And I don't think we're there. And when you work inside systems that have been created for years, and we're just putting patches on, it gets to the point that you're minimizing harm. Right? Like, you're making sure that people are more comfortable inside the environments because it can get hostile, but it's hard to decolonize a system that is not built for that. Does that make
sense? That's very interesting. Yeah. I wanna really touch more in the decolonization and the dismantling of things. So what does that entail? What do you think it needs to happen?
So for the decolonization part, at least for my understanding and, you know, studying with certain advisors, there has to be a point that you have, I mean, first, that has to do a lot with where we put our worth in more than anything. And there has to be a reclamation of power within us, each of us, right? Because the structures that are in place, they're here to almost like make us feel we're powerless and we don't have a voice. And I feel like the more people really reclaim that joy and that power, they can actually go out and make the change happen. I think the change is going to happen outside of systems, like making a business happen, right? Or starting a creative project, because there's no sense you are controlling the outcome. You're controlling everything that you want there. So I think it's kind of hard to say what, you know, what you need to do, like, you know, for the decolonization perspective for things to change. But I say the change happens outside the system.
I want to go to Proyecto Tributo a Mi Tierra. Mm-hmm. What was the idea behind Tributo a Mi Tierra, and are you still, I guess you're still going, do you have a website? What, how does that business project goes, you know, basically in terms of juggling your career, your 9-to-5, and doing this beautiful project that, by the way, it actually gives 10% of profits to Puerto Rican organizations. So that is, that is really beautiful, Jerame. So can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. So Proyecto TAM is still ongoing, of course. I do try to juggle it between my full-time job. So it's, I feel like right now it's kind of seasonal, just because there are times that I put a lot of effort on it, creating project, like products, self-care, what, you know, what my husband and I would like to collaborate on. Some other times is a little more on the down low while I do other projects, right? And I actually created it that way because I wanted it to feed my creative side, which was something that I've always been very creative, but because I got so career focused and kind of busy, that side of me kind of got lost. And then 2020, there was like this reclamation of my creativity. And that's how Proyecto TAM started, pretty much. So I started creating candles for fun, funsies during the pandemic. You know, I know a lot of us were like working from home. I was looking for ways to just explore my creativity. And then my husband at the time, he's an amazing artist. I love him. He's great. It was the same thing. Like, he was working, he was busy, and he was looking for ways to practice his art. And then while I was doing candles, then all of a sudden I was talking with him, like we were chatting and doing like these little creative sessions just to explore and brainstorm. And I was like, you know, what would be a good idea? I mean, how about you do a concept and I create candles? And because I used to see so many candles out, I know there's a lot of Latina brands, but there's not a lot of art on the candles. So me being that I love art as a whole, I was like, let's go ahead and draw something and let's do a concept and let's start a project. That way you practice your art and I keep creating my candles, which I love doing. So that's how Proyecto TAM started. And then it was like, oh, but let's go ahead and do something that represents Puerto Rico. You know, we're both from Puerto Rico. We love Puerto Rico. And then Proyecto Tributo a Mi Tierra was born, right? We're like, okay, so it's going to be a Puerto Rican concept. And I'm like, okay, so I've seen Latina candles, but I don't see a lot of Puerto Rican candles with the art of Puerto Rico. And then one day I was like going back and forth, texting with a friend. And I was telling him, you know what? I want to create a concept that is around Christmas, just because we have the longest Christmas in the world. And I feel like that's like my favorite holiday, you know, from Puerto Rico, and just like a beautiful custom. And I was like thinking, Fiesta de la Calle, Los Reyes, right? Like things that represent us as an island. And then my friend texted back. He's like, you better have a candle that's called Parranda. I was like, wait. And then like the idea, like everything just clicked. I'm like, what if I do a Parranda collection, right? We love music. It's, you know, a showcase of our instruments, the classic instruments we use in Puerto Rico. I think it will be amazing. And that's how our first kind of signature collection was born, right? Like we have wall art and we have these candles that represent Puerto Rico. And yeah, and that's pretty much how it went. And besides that, I also wanted the business to have a sustainable side to it. I've been living a very holistic lifestyle for several years, and I wanted something that, you know, it wouldn't do damage to your health. You know, sometimes when you burn candles, there are certain chemicals that will kind of go into the air, and then someone with allergies might have a reaction. So I would just wanted something to be clean. And for me too, right? Because I do have health issues that I, you know, struggle with. And that's how kind of the sustainability in the non-toxic and clean ingredients was born from. And also us, both of us, we're really into supporting local artists and just doing handmade things and vendors, like buying from vendors there. You know, if I'm buying a product, it should be here in the U.S. because that way I can support the economy here in the area of the U.S. And then some of the pieces of my earrings, I will buy from vendors from Virginia. So I'm supporting a local vendor and just like kind of moving the economy in a community driven way. And that's pretty much how the entire concept, it was just almost merging all our passions in one thing.
That is such a beautiful thing, Jerame. Where can people find Proyecto TAM?
So we have a website. It's called www.proyectotam.com. And then you can also follow us for any updates on @proyecto.tam on IG. We started a YouTube page because there's a new project coming up very, very soon.
Oh!
I can't talk about too much yet.
Okay. Well, that means that you need to come back again to talk about this project.
You know, I would love that. And then, of course, we are on Facebook as well, proyecto.tam. You can find us there for any updates. And normally when people subscribe to my newsletter inside the website, I make sure that they know what's going on. And yeah, and they actually, the people from my community, anyone who subscribes, are the ones who are able to vote for their charity of choice every quarter. So I have a voting poll that goes out. People vote, and that's where we put the money, the 10% profits every quarter. Yeah.
Jerame, we've talked about a lot of things today. We talked about your career, your opportunity to be in humanitarian disasters, your views in terms of diversity and inclusion as a Latina in the nonprofit and the corporate world. We talked about Proyecto TAM. I want to leave asking you, what is one thing that you want people to know about Jerame and about you as a Latina and as a Puerto Rican?
That's a really good question. I will say that I'm a 40-year-old woman evolving and finding her creative self again, who's also on a very profound healing journey. The last couple of years have been I have awakened to a lot of things I thought I couldn't do. You know, I battle an autoimmune disease. I battle, unfortunately, a neurological disorder also. And I've also seen a lot of loved ones lose their life because of addiction. And I've struggled with my lived experience, and yet I still remain hopeful. And I will always look for ways to contribute in a positive way to our world. And I think one of the reasons me showing up online, fighting against my fear of being seen, this is something that I struggled with for years, is hopefully to inspire other Latina women to keep dreaming and to reclaim their power and to reclaim their joy and just what makes them happy. I want others to see that you can be career driven, but you can also make space to be creative, to try things out, to experiment. And it shouldn't be one thing or the other. It's about creating a life that fulfills you, that fulfills different parts of who you are as a human being, especially in a society that assigns you in a specific role and socialize you to be one thing instead of encouraging you to be all the things you can be. I think that's, yeah.
Jerame, that's, wow. I mean, that's such a beautiful and very deep conclusion. And I think, what you're doing is great. And I see you, and what I see is beautiful. So continue to do that, be online. And you have so much, I mean, like, look, we didn't even talk about all of the stuff that you went through and how you continue to be here and strong. So I think there needs to be another time for you to come back and talk about the new projects and continue to extend this conversation. So thank you so much.
No, but thank you for giving me the space to chat with you. It was awesome. Thank you.